gut stuff might be uncomfortable for you to talk about, but it's even more uncomfortable for you to deal with. And you have better things to do this year. Don't let your gut get in the way of that. Kick off the year of the habit and get science-backed digestive support during Ritual's New Year's sale. Their 3-in-1 clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotic help support a balanced gut microbiome. The delayed release capsule is designed to help reach the colon where probiotics can actually survive and grow, so you can focus less on your gut and more on sharpening your salsa dancing skills or whatever your 2026 goals are. Start a habit that sticks with 40% off your first month, plus a free gift with purchase at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
A Rayo Original Podcast.
Joy is your birthright as a human being. We all have the DNA for joy. It's something that you experience and you cultivate from within. So no matter what your circumstance, you should be able to access that joy. We found a correlation between unresolved trauma and busying yourself. No two people are the same. So the science of your happiness is mm-hmm. very different than the science of right. my happiness, because there's only one you. What are the areas of your life that are draining your joy? Are you someone where depression runs in your family? What's happened in your past? Have you had a lot of traumas? Are you someone who attaches to people who are not available?
It's only when you recognize something that you have the power to change it.
I am built with the DNA for joy. It is literally in my genetic code. Tomorrow's not promised. Mm-hmm. So try and access and honor that joy today, and that is gratitude.
Hello, and welcome back to Rise with Roxy. When we hear the word depression, many of us imagine deep sadness or being unable to get out of bed. But depression doesn't always look that way. Sometimes it hides in plain sight, behind high achievement, productivity, or even a smile. While inside, life feels heavy or joyless. That's the reality of high-functioning depression, a subject my guest today knows deeply. Dr. Judith Joseph is a globally recognized psychiatrist, researcher, and author of High Functioning, Overcome Your Hidden Depression and Reclaim Your Joy. She's leading the world's first clinical study into high-functioning depression and has seen firsthand how often it's overlooked. Today, we'll unpack what depression really is, why stigma still silences so many, how to recognize when it's more than just a blip, and the practical steps we can all take to heal and find joy again. Before the episode begins, just a little note to say that if you do enjoy this series and this episode, please, please do rate, subscribe, follow the show, share it on social media, send it to a friend. I can't tell you how much it helps us here at the studio. Enjoy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I was so excited to just hear that your book is already in 20 countries and it's only been out since April. So that really is something extraordinary. Why do you think it's doing so well, so quickly and in so many places?
I think it's because people everywhere experience a lack of joy. It's like this universal concept, in the same way that love is universal, joy is universal. A lack of joy is something people just, they don't have a name for it. And because I study and research happiness, it's something everyone wants more of. And I think that's resonated with so many people around the world.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I have so many questions for you. And I want to start by just saying that this for me feels like a deeply sort of personal episode. And, you know, when I heard about you and your work, I was just so fascinated and intrigued, because I think depression is something that I've been around my whole life. It's in my family. I've been very close. People very, very close to me have suffered from extremely severe depression throughout their entire lives. I suffered from depression for the majority of my life, although I didn't know it for a long time and would never, and was terrified to label myself as that. So, yeah, I feel like personally, I'm really excited to dive into this with you. I thought we could just start with the basics, which is, could you begin by defining what is depression?
Well, depression is something I've studied for over 10 years. And clinical depression is when you have all of these symptoms like low energy, poor concentration, feeling guilty, hopeless, at times having changes in your appetite, changes in your sleep, changes in your energy. And then you have to have either a low mood or sadness or something called anhedonia. Now, anhedonia is a mouthful, but what it really means is a lack of pleasure, joy, and interest in things that you once enjoyed. Mm. So you have to have five or more of these symptoms, including either the anhedonia or the sadness, and it has to last at least 2 weeks or more. And then it has to impact your functioning or cause distress. But as a researcher, what I was finding was that I was seeing people coming into my office having all of these symptoms, but instead of breaking down, they were actually coping by overfunctioning, by busying themselves. Mm. When they sat still, they felt empty. When they weren't busy, they felt restless. And I thought, well, what is this? You know, it's not the textbook, you know, classic clinical depression, but it's some form of it. And why don't we have a name for it? So I set out to study this, and I published the first peer-reviewed clinical research study in high-functioning depression in the world. And at first, honestly, I thought, Roxy, like maybe 100 people reach out. But when I started talking about it, the first reel that I did about it got like over 10 million views. So I was like, this is something. People are interested in learning about
this. Okay, I want to dive deep into the high-functioning depression because actually, even from a manifesting point of view, I'm quite interested in it because I talk often about the fact that you can have all these goals, you can have success, you can have everything that you desire on paper, but that doesn't mean it's going to bring you happiness. Mm-hmm. And I think we know from so many stories that you can be productive, you can be successful, you can have a great job, but you can still be deeply unhappy. And I suppose I never considered that you might call it high functioning depression. But before we go into that, I want to talk about depression in general, just for people listening, so we can take them on that journey. So what is actually happening in the brain and the body when people actually have clinical depression?
Well, clinical depression, you have those symptoms and you either lose functioning. And when you people lose functioning in different ways. So they may not work as well if they're working, or if they're not working in the classic way at home, taking care of their kids or being caregivers, they're not doing the things that they should be doing, you know, or as well as they used to. Or, you know, socially, their relationships are really not thriving. They may be losing interest in their partner, or their relationships are literally breaking apart. So there are many ways that you can lose functioning. Let's say you're an athlete, you're not, you know, training as well, you're not as motivated. If you're in the arts, you're not getting that inspiration, so you're kind of falling flat. So the lack of functioning is really what gets people into a therapist's office, right? And so when people do have clinical depression, there are many things happening. I always say, like, know the science of your happiness. What are the areas of your life that are draining your joy, and what's causing this? So there's this unique model in my book that I talk about. It's called the biopsychosocial model. When you think about a biopsychosocial, it's almost like a fingerprint. So everyone has a fingerprint, but every single fingerprint is different. So when you look at your biopsychosocial, it's a mouthful, biologically, what's happening? Are you someone where depression runs in your family, right? Did your parents have it? Did your grandparents have it? Do your siblings have it? Because that makes you more prone to likely developing a depression if you're under, you know, a lot of stress and so forth. Or, you know, just clinically. And then psychologically, what's happened in your past? Have you had a lot of traumas? You know, are you someone who attaches to people who are not available? And so you end up in these patterns where you're constantly disappointed. You know, socially, are you in an environment that's stressful, maybe a toxic job, or, you know, maybe eating the foods that are just not the healthiest for your brain, not getting right movement? So there are different causes to depression. Do we know one? No. We know that there are multiple avenues to developing a depression. That's why you know, it's not as simple as everyone taking a pill and getting better.
Yeah.
Or else we'd all be on a pill.
Right.
Right. So then you're losing your points of joy through all of these different avenues, and no two people are the same. No two fingerprints are the same. So no two biopsychosocials are the same. So the science of your happiness is very different than the science of my happiness, because there's only one you. There'll only ever be one you. So that's why it's really important to understand where you're losing your joy.
It's interesting, because I think that I've always assumed, and I'm sure quite a lot of people listening might have had the same assumption, is that depression is really closely linked to your brain chemicals and serotonin. And I've never heard anybody speak about depression in any other way and saying, actually, it is really plausible that you have depression simply because of your trauma, simply because of your current circumstances, because you're in a toxic environment. And so I'm really fascinated by that. So why has chemical imbalance been so much the focus of depression, and how much actually is it involved?
Yeah, when I was in training about 10 years ago, you know, that was what we were taught. It's a chemical imbalance. You know, there are these neurotransmitters in the brain. But you know what? We would treat people and they weren't getting better. Not everyone was getting better. In fact, when we prescribed things like SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SNRIs, or whatever it is the antidepressant is that you end up getting, there was only like a 30% improvement rate. So only 30% of people would get better, and then you have to try another one.
Really? That low?
Very low. So we were, so that led us to be like, well, there's got to be more to this. And I wish it were as simple as just scanning someone's brain. You know, when we scan brains and we use things like functional MRIs and we look at the brain and the lighting up in certain areas, we can't say, okay, that's a depressed brain, this is a non-depressed brain, because again, it's not that straightforward. Because we're all so unique and we all have different circumstances, our depressions are going to be different. And that's why that biopsychosocial model is so important. So for example, if you're someone who has like an autoimmune condition, biologically, you're going to have way more stress there versus someone who's, let's say, physically fine, but is in an abusive relationship and they have all this unprocessed trauma. So psychologically, they're constantly in fight or flight. So they can't access joy versus someone else, let's say socially, who's taking care of small kids at home, has aging parents, has a stressful job. Their social factors are getting in the way of their joy. So we all have unique biopsychosocial. So it's really important to take a look at your own fingerprint and figure out where it is that you're losing your joy.
Wow. This is like a whole new look at depression and way of looking at it. Now, I think that there will be a lot of people listening who probably are nodding along a bit about this. When you say a lack of joy, and they're probably thinking, like, that's me. Like, I have lost that zest for life. But I think there is still such a stigma around depression. And where do you think that comes from? And do you think it is getting better since we've been talking about mental health or not? Because in my opinion, I think that we're much more open to saying we have anxiety. I think people are quite open about saying, I have anxiety, I'm anxious. I don't really hear people ever say, I suffer from depression, because I think there is still this stigma of like, what does that mean if I'm someone that suffers from depression? That must mean I'm no fun to be around, that I'm a drain, or all these things. And so I think that makes it really hard for people to admit. What are your thoughts around that?
I think it's still very present. You know, I was in the Hamptons recently, and I always test this out in different party settings. And I say, you know, like, I'll go to one side of the room and I'll be like, man, I've been so burnt out. And everyone's like, yeah, me too, me three. And they're laughing. Then I go to the other side of the room, like, man, I've been so depressed. And it's like, crickets. Like,
yes.
Oh, you should do something about that. You know, I think people are more comfortable using the word burnout.
Yeah.
And I think it's overused. I think in many cases, people are like, yeah, I'm burnt out, but it's actually depression. They just don't want to say it. They don't know it, or it's just more socially acceptable.
Yeah.
And I like to break it down in terms of, like, when you think about burnout, right? Burnout is, imagine this brain in the workplace and all of the stress from the workplace, like the demanding schedules, the people who like need things when they want it, you know, all of the stress there is causing that burnout in the workplace. But when you leave, when that brain leaves the workplace, things should get better over time because the environment isn't there. The stressors aren't there. So that brain out of the workplace does better. But what if that brain is in the workplace and you're getting all that stress and all that stuff happening and you're getting all the symptoms, then you leave the workplace and it's still not getting better. That's how I can tell that this is a depression, because burnout by definition is a workplace phenomenon. The workplace is causing the pressure. And then when you leave, over time, you get better. But when it's depression, even when you leave the workplace, you just can't relax. You can't stop, you know, moving. You feel restless when you're not busy. You feel empty when you're not working. There's something off. So the high functioning depression, that's from within. You know, you're out of the situation. The environment isn't causing it. It's something unresolved inside. And it could be, you know, maybe I'm not good enough without what I do. Maybe I don't know who I am without my role. Maybe people will stop loving me if I don't slow down, you know, if I don't stop being for them, you know, what they think I should be. So there's something unresolved in the individual that prevents them from accessing joy. They just don't know why.
Right.
And I think a lot of people can resonate with this. I think it's relatable to them. They just don't know what to do. But it's important to understand, well, where did this all start from? And in the research study that I did, we found a correlation between trauma, unresolved trauma, and busying yourself. So you think you're chasing happiness, but you really try to outrun something in the past that you haven't processed.
Wow. Just quickly for you know, you said that you can, the difference between sort of clinical depression and burnout would be that when you leave the situation you're in, you would start to feel better. And if you have clinical depression, it would continue. What are other ways and in other areas that people might differentiate a blip or just having a hard time or going through a kind of a period of sadness, let's say, and depression?
Well, typically a depression has to be 2 weeks or more.
But 2 weeks doesn't feel that long.
It doesn't. And usually very few people, you know, go through just 2 weeks, but they have to have like a criterion that we can study. But anhedonia is the hallmark. Anhedonia is that lack of interest, pleasure, and joy. And many people experience it, but they don't know what it is. They just say, oh, it's like meh, blah. Everyone feels, that's life, isn't it? No.
Well, they might use that phrase, like I have someone very close to me and I know when she's in it because she'll go, oh, I just don't care anymore.
They feel like, eh.
Now, you recognized this in yourself, didn't you? And as a psychiatrist and someone who has so much sort of expertise, you know, in this field, how quick were you to see it in yourself?
Well, you know, the thing about the medical field, I think across the board, is that mental health tends to be like the bottom of the barrel. I went from being an anesthesiologist and an operating room doctor to becoming a psychiatrist. I didn't even realize that I had been experiencing anhedonia. I just knew that, okay, I'm originally from the Caribbean, working in the operating room. It's super cold, right? You have to get up super early and no one talks to you. You know, like you're in your mask and the surgeons are, you know, on their team and you're just behind the drape. You put the patient asleep, you wake them up and you say bye. And I just found it very like not fulfilling. But I, again, I didn't even realize I was having anhedonia. I was just like, oh, this is not what I want to do. And then going into psychiatry, you know, you have to talk about your feelings. I was the one psychiatrist in my training who was like, you guys complain a lot. And they were like, no, Judith, you got to validate. And I was like, ah, all right. Even being a psychiatrist, prescribing medications, treating serious mental health issues, I didn't even realize when I was depressed. I was sitting at my desk. And it was 2020. I was running this very busy lab in the middle of the city, small child at home, frontline worker, you know, who was my husband at the time. And I was giving this talk to this massive hospital system from my desk. And like halfway through the talk, I was like, oh my God, I think I'm depressed. It just kind of like hit me. And I thought, well, on the outside, I'm thriving. You know, I'm always on TV. I'm like doing all these wonderful things, but no one knows that I'm really suffering in silence. So I wondered how many people were just like me. And that was really my inspiration for studying this, because being in such a busy city where I see so many professionals who are thriving but secretly suffering, I just thought, well, I've got to start talking about this. You know, how can I help people if I don't talk about what I'm experiencing? And that's why I was so surprised that people had this response to my work. You know, I was getting these messages from doctors, from surgeons saying, finally, there's something that is a name for what I'm experiencing. But like in our subculture of medicine, you just don't talk about it. You know, you put the patient first. Mm-hmm. You just push through your pain. And healthcare professionals, we see a lot of trauma. I know when I was in the OR operating room, seeing death and like, you know, suffering, you don't talk about it. It's like, well, who's going to take this next case? Mm-hmm. You know, I remember doing a code and we're doing chest compressions and then someone passed and it's like, okay, well, who's going to go in the next room? It's like business as usual. It's a profession where you're just taught to push down your pain, push down your suffering, move on to the next. The problem with that is that if you keep pushing down your pain, you eventually lose the capacity to even feel your joy. And that's why a lot of us are walking around like, meh.
Do you think in some ways high functioning depression can be born out of a coping mechanism, mm-hmm. but because you're trying to protect yourself by not feeling the pain, the hurt, the anger, whatever it is that's coming up as a result of the things you've been through, that actually we don't realize that we're doing more harm than good, but we're trying to protect ourselves, but it's just not worked out the way that we hoped it would?
Absolutely. You know, when you think of pain and trauma in the classic sense, mm-hmm. people usually cope by avoiding thinking about it. They avoid people, places, situations that trigger you. But folks who are high functioning avoid dealing with it by busying themselves, by just, you know, working, taking on more, you know, taking on a side hustle or two, mm-hmm. never really facing or processing that pain.
Yeah.
But eventually something's going to give, you know, mm-hmm. eventually your body breaks down or you mentally break down or you cope in ways that are just not sustainable by drinking too much or
you know,
whatever it is that you end up doing.
And so I wonder if like this kind of idea of burnout, the fact that so many of us are talking about feeling burned out, is it happening more because more people are using busyness as a way to escape, and so they don't even have the resilience they would need to be able to handle that stuff because they're already kind of, they're coming at it from a place of like pain anyway. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think busying is more of a coping mechanism than ever before because of technology, you know? Mm. For the first time in our, you know, human civilization, we have access to work anywhere. You could be on an island in the middle of nowhere and mm-hmm. still be able to busy yourself. Yeah. You can still, you know, you can't unplug.
No.
There's no form of that anymore. So I think that plays a large role in it.
I mean, I know for sure I have used it myself to cope with a lot. And I think that when I started my career, sort of everything was thriving so much at work. And when things were breaking down in my relationship, every single moment, what I noticed was I had this knee-jerk reaction. If I was having an uncomfortable conversation, if things started to feel a bit toxic at home, if the environment wasn't nice, like in that instant, I would pick up my phone and start emailing. Mm-hmm. My work was absolutely my best escape from all of it. And so I never, ever felt like I dealt with it. And I remember about 3 or 4 years into my career, which had been doing really well, what I noticed was that every second I wasn't working, I was still thinking about how much I hated myself. Mm. And these looping thoughts of self-loathing were so consuming, but only in the moments that I wasn't working. And so I had this sort of epiphany where I thought, what is the point in having created all this success if I can never enjoy it? Mm. Like, it feels like such a waste to thrive in your profession, in your life, and not be able to actually find joy in it. And that's why I think your work is so important, because I think so many people have found a way to thrive professionally, to build a life for themselves that they once dreamt of, but they haven't been able to do perhaps the healing required or have the awareness about things like high functioning depression that allows them to actually enjoy what they've worked so hard for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, what you're describing and you're being so vulnerable about, a lot of people come to me with that. Mm-hmm. They'll say, you know, on the outside, I should be happy. I have all these things. I've worked so hard. I've accomplished so much. But when I sit still, I do feel empty and I feel unlovable and unworthy. And then I explain to them that this is a downstream effect of trauma. There are 30 plus symptoms of trauma. And one of them is feeling unworthy, internalizing blame, shame, and guilt. So you don't want to talk about what you're going through because you feel like, well, what do I have to complain about? I should be happy. Mm-hmm. Then there's guilt about not being happy and enjoying what you've worked hard for. So it's like this vicious spiral and this pattern that just won't be broken until you acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. And so I hear this a lot from people just like you. And when I explain that to them and I say, what you're experiencing is directly related to that trauma. And so validate that, the first step in my 5V method, mm-hmm. validate it, meaning accepting it without judgment. So you're accepting that I am not happy. I am lacking joy. And you're not trying to, judge it. You're not trying to rationalize it. You're just radically accepting that. And that is the first step.
I think, and I really want to go through your 5 V's. I think that actually that moment where you can just say to yourself, I'm really not happy. There's a real relief in that. Mm-hmm. There's a real feeling of like a weight being lifted. Because I think it's only when you recognize something that you have the power to change it. And so in that moment that you can say to yourself, maybe I do have high functioning depression, is the moment that you know that you can make things better. Mm-hmm. Because it's, you have to get to that point before you can do anything about it.
Well, that relief is because in neuroscience, if you don't know what you're feeling, many of us feel very confused, and that uncertainty is unsettling. The human brain does not like uncertainty. Yeah. So validation is, I use this analogy of, imagine you're in this really dark room, pitch black, you can't see anything, and you hear this very loud crash. You know, some of us would start screaming, some would start running, some would start squinging, but mm-hmm. like if you turn the light on and you saw, oh, that was like this vase that fell, I'm safe, you know? That in itself is a therapeutic act because you're decreasing the uncertainty. Mm. So validation is like turning the light on your emotion and saying, oh, I'm really unhappy.
Yeah.
And that in itself is therapeutic. It's calming because it decreases the uncertainty. You know what you're dealing with.
Honestly, that's so great to hear that. That analogy is so amazing because you can use that in so many circumstances, not just in validating, let's say depression, but even, for example, let's say you've had a really tough situation with a friend and you're feeling just like so frustrated by the situation, and that frustration is like, oh, it's just like it's consuming. But the moment you can actually just say, I feel deeply hurt mm-hmm. and rejected and abandoned, when you can admit what the feelings are that are causing the frustration, that makes you feel better. And I think, in every situation where there's this feeling of unease and overwhelm, if we can actually identify the root emotion that's driving it, we can start to actually just feel better immediately.
Yeah. And it's the hardest thing to do, like acknowledging and accepting without judgment. Many people will come to my office and they'll say, I'm angry all the time, especially a lot of men. And then I'll say, well, really, is it anger? How do you know? Well, because I threw something when I got home and I slammed something. Okay, well, let's really sit in it and try to figure out what this is. And you're turning the light on slowly. And actually, it was anxiety. You know, you were worried because you were not going to be a provider. You thought you were going to be a failure. So that anger, it looked like anger on the outside, but it was really stemming from anxiety. Mm. The same with what you're talking about, rejection. You know, people say, oh, I'm just really hurt. But what is it? It's a fear of abandonment. Mm-hmm. So turning that light on and knowing what you're dealing with is so important because mm-hmm. if you don't turn that light on and if you mm-hmm. don't really acknowledge it and accept it, mm-hmm. then the interventions won't work because mm-hmm. you're treating the wrong thing.
Absolutely. Okay. So let's do your 5 V's. Let's go through them because mm-hmm. these 5 V's are what you offer to people to help them through to find joy again, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the first V is validation. What's next?
Well, the second one is venting. And the interesting thing about five is I traveled the world over 30 countries, like understanding psychiatry and, and joy and happiness. And the number five comes up a lot. And I think it's because most of us have five fingers. Some of us don't, but most of us do. So it's a universal number.
Right.
But when I talk to my clients about this, I say, imagine that you're looking at your hand and you're saying to yourself, I am built with the DNA for joy. It is literally in my genetic code. And I just forget how to access it sometimes. So tap into one of the five V's and then try to reclaim just a point or two every day. Don't try to do all five because it's too much.
Okay.
One or two. Right. The second is venting.
Okay.
So I have this
lab. I love the sound of that already. I'm like, there's nothing better than a vent.
Seriously. But like, so in my lab in Manhattan, I bring people in and I do this experiment where I have a big tank of water and a red balloon. And everyone takes a turn trying to like dunk this red balloon into this tank of water. 100% of the time, that balloon will pop up. Why? You can't outmath physics, right? But we'll then take turns trying to deflate that balloon. And then once it's flat, you can push that balloon right down to the bottom of the tank. If you don't slowly release your emotions like that balloon, they will pop up in your health. It'll pop up in your relationships. It pops up in ways you can't control. So it's important to figure out how to release the pressure in your system. And venting could be verbal, the classic sense, right? If you have a therapist, you can vent all you want. You pay them. But if you don't have a therapist, just be very mindful about maybe one or two people in your life that you that there's real reciprocity, meaning I vent to you, you vent to me.
Yeah.
There's understanding that this is, you know, a trusting relationship. You vent with emotional consent. You say, oh, by the way, can I talk to you? You don't want to just be trauma dumping on people.
Yeah.
And you think about it intentionally. You know, you don't want to vent to your children because your kids will worry about you. You don't want to vent to your employees because you pay them. They have to listen to you, right? So pick people where there's true reciprocity, where there's an intention of resolving a situation, not just trauma dumping. Because the recent data shows that if you're just trauma dumping on people, you actually don't get better. You feel worse after you vent.
So what's the difference between venting with intention and venting without?
So with intention, you're trying to come up with a resolution. You're not just trying to get someone on your side. You're not just trying to feel better just in the moment. You really want to get a clear, you know, decision made based on thoughtfulness. You know, you're going to someone like, I need help with this. I need to figure this out. And I need your honest opinion. And there's empathy there. There's emotional reciprocity. If you're in a situation, I'm going to help you out too. You know, I'm not just going to tell you what you want to hear, right? A lot of us, when we trauma dump, we're just make me feel better in the moment. Tell me what I want to hear, that I'm right. Well, that's not really with intention, right?
Because what about, like, for example, with my sisters? Okay, we have like a sisters chat and we vent to each other all day long. I don't know how much we're looking for solutions because I think we're just like, oh, so-and-so is pissing me off today and fucking hell and this happened and and I don't feel like it's very intentional, but I do generally feel better afterwards.
Well, there's emotional reciprocity there.
Right. So
and
is
you
that
trust
the difference? Yeah.
You know, like there's that relationship that's been nurtured over time. You may not have sat down formally and said, oh, this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
But there's that background.
Right.
But a lot of times I'm working with people who, again, they're used to burying their feelings. So what happens is that they don't have this practice in place. So it pops up in ways. So they'll go and vent to their teams like, I can't believe this happened and da, da, da.
Oh, so venting at rather than venting about in a safe space.
With the intention of a resolution.
Right.
Because maybe on an unconscious level, when you're like to your sisters, like, because I have two sisters too. On an unconscious level, you're like, you know, I feel really bad about what's happening. But if I tell you about it, I know you're going to like support me, send me a meme, you know, like there's that backstory.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't do that. You know,
right.
They don't get into that practice of like, okay, I know why I'm doing this. I'm mindful about it. I feel this way. I need to do this. It's just like, blah, blah, blah. It's like a sprinkler.
Okay.
It's not really intentional.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Well, and also venting doesn't have to be verbal. It can be through writing in a journal.
Yeah. Yeah.
praying, singing.
I love worry dumping.
Yeah. I mean, when you put it onto a paper, you're not hurting anyone, right? That's for you. The third V is values. Values are things that bring your life meaning and purpose. And I often say, you know, values are things that are priceless, not necessarily with price tags. Many of us chase the things with the price tags. And I was one of those people too. If you're ever in Manhattan and you look at my office, there's like at least 10 degrees plastered around, too many degrees to hang, you know? Mm-hmm. I used to chase the accolades, you know, and that was what drove me, but it led me to feel so empty. And when I had to dial back and look at a time in my life where I truly felt meaning and purpose, it was when I was a lot younger, didn't have much, came from an immigrant family. But even though we didn't have a lot, we would always reach out to the community. We'd always give. And that's where I found my meaning and purpose. So I had to dial back and start doing that work again. Mm-hmm. And that's making me feel full and fed spiritually versus chasing the accolades. But for others, it could be something else. You know, if you find that you don't know what brings your life meaning and purpose, you may have to go back in time and be a little archaeologist and dig up your past to find that moment. But every one of us has values, and many of us just forgot what they were.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. What's next?
The fourth is vitals. So these are things that support your body and your brain, because you only get one body and brain.
Yeah.
I have a 9-year-old, and since she was 2, I was like, you know, how many bodies did God give you? And she's always like, one, mommy.
No.
I'm like, well, what do you got to do with it? Take care of it. And this is something I tell her every day. Mm. We only get one body and brain. So when you eat food, think about, you know, is this nourishing my brain? You know, and there are these brain foods that have been well studied in nutritional psychiatry, where they've actually put people into a group where they're eating the brain foods and a group where they're just eating the standard diet. The group that eats the brain food, they think faster. So a lot of them, you know, have better concentration, focus. They feel happier. They feel more energetic. So really be intentional about what you put into your body, not just for aesthetics, but for brain functioning.
What are some of these brain foods?
Oh, blueberries, superfood. You know, within an hour of eating a blueberry, the amount of blood that goes to your brain.
Really?
Yes. It's a superfood.
Within an hour?
Yes, within an hour.
How many do you have to eat?
Well, a typical standard amount, but
fine. Yeah,
No.
Because sometimes with these studies, I'm wondering, like, you know, do you have to have like loads, or could you just have like a normal portion size and it would have an effect?
Yeah. There are studies done at Harvard where you're looking at the green leafy vegetables and then antioxidant things like berries and fatty fishes, mm-hmm. Things like mussels, believe it or not, mm-hmm. All support your brain. If you're going to eat chocolate, swap out the milk for the dark chocolate.
Right.
And all of these things decrease the inflammation in your brain, mm-hmm. because we're learning that inflamed brains they don't function as well.
Right.
So you want to be mindful about that. Movement, you know, certain mm-hmm. types of movement, walking, you know, if you're not a big gym person, dancing, get that movement in because that helps your brain. Sleeping, mm-hmm. making sure that you're practicing good sleep hygiene, not being on your devices at night. And things like, you know, being careful about your exposure to technology, because we're learning that excessive tech use is leading to a lot of adult depression and anxiety. There's like this whole movement with teens, but we're neglecting the adults as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the old model of depression being like just, you know, the chemical imbalance, mm-hmm. it's not what we now believe is true. What we believe now is that it's the connectivity between the neurons, the brain cells, that leads to happier brain. So if we can nourish those connections and strengthen them, then the brain is actually healing.
Well, and how do we strengthen them? Through food, antioxidants.
Yes. Eating these foods
daily,
having a very intentional, mindful diet about getting these nutrients in and avoiding the things like these ultra processed foods that are increasing the inflammation.
Because I've also, you know, heard a lot and with many experts and speakers that, is it 95% of our brain serotonin is produced in the gut?
Yes.
And so there's been a lot of kind of conversation about whether we can sort of, I actually remember writing an article like 10 years ago of, can I eat myself happy? And you know, how true is that? Like, does that apply as well with all of this?
It's a part of that biopsychosocial, mm-hmm. you know? When you look at the Venn diagram, biological and social overlap for reasons. So biologically, you know, having that inflammation in the brain overlaps with the social because you're not eating the nutrients to decrease that, to support the brain. It's not like you can eat your way and it's just one avenue. There are many avenues to joy. And food is one of those. Food, movement, but you also have to think about your, you know, your genetics and your medical issues and your psychological issues, right? So it's a combined approach. And I think it's way more hopeful because if you know that there are all these avenues to joy versus just one, that gives you way more options versus, well, just one pill. Oh, it doesn't work. Oh, must be me.
Absolutely.
There are different ways to getting that.
Okay. So we have validation, venting. What was before vitals? No, I really want to remember because I'm good at this.
Values.
Values. There we go. What is number five?
The fifth is vision. Vision is important because if you don't have something to look forward to, you get stuck in the past.
Yes.
And for high achievers, you know, we often don't celebrate our wins. So it's important to plan that joy or else it will not happen. And, you know, I get a lot of pushback on this sometimes on social, like joy is supposed to be spontaneous. Well, I don't know about you, but I have a 9-year-old. I have elderly parents. I have a lab to take care of. If I don't plan my joy, it's not happening. So I have to be intentional about making space for joy.
Yes. I love this because it's so aligned with what I say, which is that I obviously my work is a lot about manifestation. And so I've put this disclaimer on manifesting that manifesting your goals won't make you happy. However, goals are so important for our mental health because we do need something to look forward to. We need a reason to get out of bed in the morning. We need, I think, having forward momentum and something to drive excitement and motivation is so important for our overall well-being. But it's how can you balance the pursuit of something whilst also being able to really embrace the here and now, to be able to find joy in the ordinary moments, in the mundane, in the ordinary. And by being able to balance both of those, for me, is where I can feel my best and where I think a really happy place can be found.
Well, yeah. And I explain it as, you know, versus the idea of chasing happiness. When I talk about planning joy, it's about in that moment, trying to squeeze as many experiences out of what you're doing in the here and now. So I explain it in this way because, you know, in my practice, I have this traditional therapy practice where I see people for therapy and medications. Then I have this lab where I study joy. So when the therapy patients come in, they'll be like, "Dr. Judith, I just want to be happy one day." And I'm like, "Okay, well, what does that mean?" "Well, I'll be happy when I get that partner or I get the job or I have a family." It's always this external thing.
Yeah.
But the science shows us that when you think that way, even when you get those things, you're still not happy, right? So think about happiness as external. It's dependent on all these things that happen on the outside. Whereas joy is different. It's internal. It's something that you experience and you cultivate from within, right? So no matter what your circumstance, you should be able to access that joy. I explain it that way because in the science, when we determine if someone's actually becoming happier, we'll add up things like, okay, well, when you ate your food, did you enjoy it? Did it taste yummy? You know, when you took a rest, did you feel refreshed? When you were lonely and reached out to someone, did you feel loved, seen, and connected? Those are the points that we actually add up. It's those experiences. So that's, it makes it more attainable to try and access those points. So when I say plan joy, I'm like, okay, I'm going to plan joy today. I'm going to, between my clients, I'm going to sit down and like actually taste my sandwich, you know, I'm going to be intentional about it, close my laptop, you know, and just try and like, you know, figure out what the ingredients are. And that's training my brain to be mindful in my experiences to access joy versus, well, I'll be happy when I'm at the end of the day and I'm done with my day. Because then I'm in bed and I'm, my mind can't relax and I've missed a whole day without accessing the actual joy.
And so in that sense, you know, I would say that gratitude is And this, again, it's what I say a lot, is that for me, like, gratitude is how you build a happy life, because a happy life is just a culmination of so many small moments of joy that you can actually appreciate and notice and be in. How important is gratitude in the as an antidote to depression?
It's so important. It's so key. You know, what you're experiencing in the moment and acknowledging and making space to revere and to honor, you know, that is what joy is, because tomorrow is not promised. You know, there's a huge assumption that, okay, I'm just not going to experience joy in this moment and I'll just wait. Well, tomorrow's not promised. Mm-hmm. So try and access and honor that joy today. And that is gratitude.
Yeah, absolutely. How did you get yourself out of high functioning depression? Was it through these five V's? And how long did it take you to start feeling joy again?
Well, validation was the one where I put the most work into, because I was so accustomed to pushing things down and to just doing. And validation is actually the hardest step. And so I've gotten so good at it that, like, I'm literally like shrinking my own brain, you know, constantly. Yeah. Like, well, how am I feeling? Why do I feel that way?
So talk me through, like, how does that, how is that in practice for you day to day? What's your, like, process?
Oh, I have this constant inner dialogue of like, what am I feeling this moment? And, you know, why is it that I said that? And it's like, it's really helped me to understand myself versus just like, worry about that later, push through. You know, get things done. And in moments, you know, let's say I'm feeling anxious. Well, okay, well, what is it that I'm anxious about? And, you know, okay, it's okay to be anxious. What am I going to do about it? And how am I going to talk to this person about this feeling? Mm-hmm. You know, it's really helped me to figure out my next steps and to feel better about my next steps versus in the past, I wouldn't be as reflective. And then I do something that I regret and then feel guilty. And it's a whole vicious spiral. So I have really gotten, I think, better at that inner dialogue and then figuring out what to do next. Mm-hmm. And also the gratitude has really helped me tremendously.
Yeah. Do you have a particular gratitude practice, or is it for you just an attitude of gratitude and a way of living?
For me, it's important to say it out loud. Mm-hmm. When I hear my words, it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a Caribbean household where, you know, you're just supposed to be grateful for whatever you have, but not reflective, which is a different type of gratitude. Now I'm reflective and then I say it out loud. And for me, that's helpful. But for my neurodivergent clients, some of them, you know, saying it out loud doesn't feel authentic for them. So writing it down on paper and seeing it visually has been powerful for them. For others, you know, it could be, if you're more of a creative, you know, celebrating yourself through what you're wearing. There are different ways to practice this. But personally, sometimes I just like talk to myself out loud. And then I thought, well, is there data on this? And I looked it up, and there are recent data about people who talk out loud to themselves, getting to resolutions, feeling better. So, you know, you have to figure out what's authentic for you. But that's what I found for myself.
Oh, I love that. A lot of people, when they want to do like a practice, like a gratitude practice, and let's say they want to write it down, a lot of people want to use their phone. Is there a real difference in the impact it has if you write it on your phone versus you write it like pen to paper?
Well, the beauty of using a pen and paper is that you're accessing different sensory areas of your brain. So when you're writing, you're like listening to the sound. And that's, I love this. I love that ASMR, that sound of the pen and the paper. And then, you know, even the act of like picking out your notebooks, all of that, that's visually pleasing. You know, there's so many more elements to when you're using hand-eye coordination in that way versus just the technology. The problem also with technology is that, and I've done this many times, if I use my phone or my device to write something down, another thing will pop up and I get distracted, you know, and it's just another way for me to not be intentional about carrying through with what I was going to do. So I love the distraction from the technology, like just using the hand, like manual things. I think it's a better way to be grounded. But for some of us, we don't have that opportunity. Yeah. We have to just do with what we have in the moment. Mm-hmm. But I prefer non-digital ways of recording things.
Yeah. So for somebody listening who is maybe feeling, like we kind of said, they've come to this episode because they are noticing that they don't have joy in their life, they're not feeling good. What kind of message would you give to that person? I often say when we're feeling good, we think we'll never feel bad again. Mm-hmm. We're like, I've cracked it. I've cracked life. Things are always going to be good. But when we're in a really low point, it's really hard to feel that we'll ever feel better again. It feels so overwhelming and hopeless at times. But what would you say to somebody to give them some hope?
Well, you know, joy is your birthright as a human being. You know, we all have the DNA for joy. And I think, you know, try to understand the science of your happiness. There's only one you, and there will only ever be one you in the history of the universe and the future of the universe, just you. I mean, that always gives me chills. So really understand where it is you're losing your joy. You know, rather than saying, I just want to be happy and you're chasing someone else's version of happy, where are you losing your joy? And if you understand that, you know, using that fingerprint, the biopsychosocial, then you know the areas to focus, you know where to add that joy back. But if you don't understand the science of your happiness, you may never find happiness because you don't even understand where you're losing your joy.
Mm. And what do you say to someone? Because I know there are lots of people listening who feel like they're losing their joy because they are so overwhelmed with their job and their responsibilities as a parent, and they're struggling financially, and life just feels heavy. And they don't feel that they can change their circumstances. They feel stuck in that. How can that person find joy, even if they can't currently change their circumstances?
That's the beauty of the biopsychosocial, right? Because that person socially has all these things that are just overwhelming them. But then what are they doing psychologically? You know, there are ways to practice. And there's a 5-4-3-2-1 method I talk about in my book, where you can actually practice 5 minutes a day to decrease that fight or flight. And so you're accessing one or two points of joy there, or the biological part of it, you know, what are you doing to decrease your inflammation? So even if your social bucket is overwhelming, you're getting points in the psychological, you're getting points in the biological. For others, maybe socially their life is fine, their job is okay, but biologically they have, you know, this uncontrolled autoimmune condition. Well, that's where you need to focus your efforts. You need to get down that inflammation. You need to probably work with multiple specialists. That's why it's important to understand the science of your happiness, because there are different ways of obtaining even one or two points of joy that you otherwise would have been leaving on the table because you weren't even aware of that.
Yeah.
And again, in the research, you know, we're excited when you get one more point, two more points. It's a reframe versus like, I just want to be happy and everything buttoned up. Shift your gears, start getting one or two points because you're getting closer to happiness.
Could you just share one daily practice that you think our listeners could use to spark joy in their life?
Well, I love the 5-4-3-2-1 method. Mm-hmm. I use this at my desk in between clients. So I'll usually do it with like a cup of tea or any beverage, but I'll hold that cup and I'm thinking about five things that I see. So it could be, you know, describing the way that the fluid is moving, the color, the glistening lights, my fingernails, the cup itself, right? Then four things I can feel. So that could be the temperature, the mug. I have this soft, cozy carpet in my office, and then the cushion. And then three things that you can hear. And so New York City is pretty loud. So I have these like oil diffusers and just listening to, I love the sound of my fingernail on the cup, and then the sound of the fluid, and two things I can smell. And my favorite is chamomile lavender tea, but for others it's mint. So I just try to smell the aroma, and then I wear this like fragrance, and then one thing I taste, and then I just sip it and then be really mindful about what the taste is. So when you're doing that practice, even for like 1 or 2 minutes, you're not thinking about, at least I'm not thinking about the future or the past. I'm very present in that one act. And I'm like really enjoying my tea, you know?
Yeah.
So I think for folks who are busy, who have a hard time just sitting still, This is a practice that has been evidence-based to keep you grounded in your body. And what happens is that when you're overwhelmed, you feel detached from yourself. Some people will describe not even remembering where they are at times. Like, that happened? I don't remember that. That derealization, depersonalization happens. So the 5-4-3-2-1 is a grounding tool that you can use to stay present and to access joy in that moment.
And there's so much more in your book as well. And I really, I love books, and I think a book can change your life. And I really think that. And I think somebody that's listening that is in need of support, who feels like they're just missing that love of life and they just want to get back there, I think this book is such a fantastic way to start, and I think will absolutely be life-changing. So I really hope they pick up this book and get it. And thank you for writing it. It must be so fulfilling, and you must have had lots of incredible stories from it. How are you feeling?
Thank you. It really is a blessing. You know, every time I go somewhere, people are like, you know, I was just in Fashion Week and they were like, oh my gosh, like, you're the person that wrote this book. It changed my life. So again, that was what made me feel purposeful and meaningful. Yeah. You know, it's that giving to others. So helping others find joy has brought me so much joy. I'm so grateful.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being such an amazing guest on Rise with Roxy. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to that incredible episode with Dr. Judith Joseph. I found that so fascinating, and it was so incredible to look at this kind of like lack of joy, that lack of that moment where you kind of lose that zest for life in a different way, and recognizing it as high functioning depression, I think will be actually so validating and so helpful for so many people. And if you're listening and you have been feeling like that, just know there is a way out. You can buy her book now, and I really hope it helps you. Until next time, keep rising, and I'll see you on the next episode.